Okay, so last time we were, last two lectures, we were talking about what constitutes a wetland, the presence of a wetland. And if a wetland is present, which requires three different attributes, something related to hydrology, soil, and the type of plants there. Then the next thing we asked is whether or not it would actually be covered under federal law. Okay, we know that a wetland is present. These are the criteria. Now, is it covered and protected under federal law? And so we talked about what is required to be protected under federal law. And basically, it has to be, the wetland has to be connected to a navigable waterway or to a tributary that is connected to a navigable waterway. If for a tributary that is non-navigable, that's connected to a navigable waterway, the water needs to be flowing for at least 3 months. And its associated wetlands, as I mentioned, are also included in the protection. If that is not the case, so you have basically an intermittent stream with less, with a short hydro period, then you have to establish what is called a significant nexus, meaning a significant connection between that tributary and the navigable waterway. And that if you remove the wetlands associated with the tributary or do something to that non-navigable tributary with the short hydro period, that it will affect things downstream, hydrologically or biologically. Okay? And then, so that's federal law. That's currently the way it's stated right now. State law is basically if you do anything to water outside of your that flows off of your property, above ground or below ground, pretty much anything that can affect even the bacterial composition, it can be considered pollution, and you're polluting the waters of the state, and you need a permit to do that. TDEC is the enforcer. almost sound like Bush. I'm the decider. I'm the enforcer. All right, now TDEC is the enforcer of our Tennessee Wetland Conservation Act, okay, and the ARAP permit, the ARAPs, ARAP, which is a aquatic resource alteration permit. And they do not generally enforce that act to the fullest of their capability, because technically even grazing cattle, like we talked about before, could be counted underneath of that, because you're changing the water quality, you're changing the chemical properties and the biological properties of the water source. Okay? Or I should say of the waters of Tennessee. Okay. Who is the regulatory authority under the feds for federal jurisdiction? The Corps of Engineers. There are two other federal entities that may come into play depending on issues related with wetlands. Any idea who those agencies may be?
Fish and Wildlife.
Yeah, Fish and Wildlife Service, and why would they come into concern?
Because what happens in the wetland affects all the fish and wildlife. Yeah. Associated with that wetland.
So, yeah, it's in particular, it's U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, but it's threatened and endangered species that Fish and Wildlife Service can come in through the Endangered Species Act and have authority. The other agency would be deals with quality, water quality? EPA, right. So EPA can be can come in and enforce its laws that it has jurisdiction over if there's some change in water quality that violates water quality laws. Okay. But as far as filling in a wetland, destroying a wetland that is under federal jurisdiction. It is the Corps of Engineers that permitting has to go through. All right? And I guess we talked about permitting some, just a little bit, that yes, you can destroy wetlands, but we have a no net loss policy in the United States. It was established in the first Bush administration, 1992. And if you destroy a wetland, you have to do something. You have to basically restore. If you destroy, you have to restore a wetland or create a wetland, and that is through a process called wetland mitigation. Okay? And there's the wetland mitigation process is a relatively complex process in which wetlands are ranked. The type of wetland you're destroying is ranked, and it's related to the type that you're restoring. And you, as a person destroying, can buy acres of wetlands to compensate for the wetlands that you're destroying, okay? And there are certain agencies that are associated with, that have this bank of wetlands that can be used for mitigation. Most of those are state and federal agencies. Conservation organization that has some in Tennessee, the Nature Conservancy. In many states, the Nature Conservancy has some. Okay. So is that clear? Now, what we're getting into now is something different completely. We're talking about now classifying wetlands. This lecture, and actually the lecture after this group, which will be by Dr. Roberts from Tennessee Tech, he'll be coming over and talking about another classification system, have to do with basically classifying. This is the one we're talking about is a biological classification system. The one that Dr. Roberts will talk about is one that stream hydrologists usually use. It's a hydrogeomorphic classification. So two different classification systems. So we will talk about classifying wetlands, and this is the one that basically biologists use in talking about different types of wetlands they have in a certain area, etc. And as a wetland biologist, you create maps that estimate areas of these different types of wetlands, okay? So we'll go through this. This classification system is relatively lengthy, and it was published shortly after, 1979, shortly after the Clean Water Act, Section 404 was added, that actually defined what a wetland was, the criteria for a wetland. Then this publication came out through Fish and Wildlife Service saying, how do you classify wetlands? But it has no regulatory authority, okay? It's simply classification. It doesn't say where a wetland is. Once you know where a wetland is, then you classify it, either hydrogeomorphically or through a biological classification system. Most often we're using this one. Okay, is that clear? So, why classify wetlands? Why do you want to classify wetlands? What's some thoughts? Without looking at the notes.
Some sort of organization for databases.
Yeah, some sort of organization for databases. Absolutely. Keeping track of the wetland types you have out there. When we talk about management later, we'll talk about actually changing certain types, what are called subclasses of wetlands, from one type to another. And some subclasses are more productive with respect to habitat quality, or have higher habitat quality with respect to producing food resources, etc., for example, for waterfowl, or there's certain subclasses that shorebirds like. So you can keep track of that, and as your wetland goes through succession, you can make management decisions, conservation decisions based on those. So kind of keeping track of acreage, etc., make management conservation decisions. What else? Make nice fancy maps with those. What else?
Consistency of terminology.
Yeah. I mean, keep the jargon, let's establish our jargon and let's keep it consistent so that when you as a biologist for TWRA or Ducks Unlimited or Fish and Wildlife Service, talk to somebody in Tennessee Valley Authority or Nebraska Game and Fish or whatever that is called out in Nebraska, that if you say a scrub shrub wetland, you know what it means and they know what it means, okay? And you can have a conversation. If, again, like we talked about before, if you say a marsh, well, that can mean a hell of a lot of different things. It usually means a palustrine emergent wetland with persistent vegetation. But marsh can mean lots of things to a lot of different people. Okay, so why classify wetlands? Well, once you delineate their edges, okay, let's see what is inside. Okay, let's, as Jonathan mentioned, let's keep an inventory of it. Let's create maps. We can estimate their area. And actually, again, when you delineate wetlands, again, the whole idea that what we learned in your mapping assignment will take both things into consideration. You will use wetland delineation criteria to find out the edge of the wetland. Okay, and you can map the edge based on Corps of Engineers criteria. And then you'll use Fish and Wildlife Service criteria to then map within the wetland to see what it's composed of. And of course, boundaries of development, if you have development, if many contractors just want to know where the edge of the wetland is just so that they stay out of the wetland. And so a lot of times when you're delineating wetlands, you are indicating where its edge is. Now, if you get into the wetland and you are actually going to fill in the wetland if you're going to fill in the wetland or you're going to put a levee through it, which is filling in, you need to actually estimate the type, the area of the wetland that you're filling in, and you need to also indicate the type of the wetland that you're filling in. And so that's another important aspect, is knowing what type of wetland. And instead of just describing it generally, use a classification system. And this is usually the one that's used. So again, we can create maps for management practices, for, again, excavation. And then ultimately, again, you need to know the type of wetland you have, because that is going to be determine what you're going to have to mitigate. All right? All right, an example of wetland maps here. On the left-hand side, you can see a black and white aerial photograph of some wetlands, actually from some work that we did down in Puerto Rico. This is the Caribbean Sea right here. There's a river that comes back down through here, and then it kind of comes back towards this dark black portion towards the top right of the image, and that river actually comes down through here. And this is basically mangrove swamp, and then this actually blends into what's called pterocarpus. So this is a forested wetland system, and then here we have estuarine lagoons and other open water, and then you have vegetation here that also is a type of wetland. So again, part of your wetland mapping assignment is to have download DOQQ, have an image like this, and then create something like this. Okay, on the right-hand side, where these different colors represent different wetland types. Okay, so here's mangrove right here. That's a broadleaf evergreen. This is a broadleaf deciduous forested wetland, and then we have different types of wetlands here. Persistent, emergent, non-persistent, emergent wetlands, etc. So that will be the process that you will go through in your wetland mapping assignment. Okay? All right, next slide. So what is the classification system? It was published in 1979 by a group of scientists. Lou Corden was the lead from Fish and Wildlife Service, Virginia Cairo USGS, Galay from University of Rhode Island, and LaRoe from NOAA. And this classification system has withstood the test of time. And here you have the actual publication, the first page of the publication, the handout. The whole publication is on the website. And again, if you are unclear with any of these aspects that I'm going through, go into that classification system and read it, okay, to provide clarification. And it's actually a pretty good, it's pretty easy to read, quite frankly. All right, so again, this is a biological classification system. It does not have jurisdictional authority. And it classifies not only wetlands, but also what are called deep water habitats. This, again, as I mentioned before, deep water habitats refer to the aquatic system. That's usually what you, or the terminology you're more familiar with. Okay, so wetlands and deep water or aquatic systems. All right, so. Any questions? Again, yeah, as I mentioned, the jurisdictional authority comes from the Corps of Engineers, the 1987 manual. Any questions, y'all? All right. So, let me turn this light back on over here. We've already talked a little bit about what is the difference between, or where is the boundary between a wetland and a deep water system, or an aquatic system. And for non-tidal, where is it, y'all?
2 meters.
At 2 meters. Greater than 2 meters at low water level. So as low as that water gets on an average year, not a drought year, it at that level where it's 2 meters deeper, then that's where, for non-tidal systems, where the deep water system begins. Okay? So deep water systems are flooded, permanently flooded rivers that are greater than 2 meters deep. Not all rivers or creeks, etc., are greater than 2 meters deep. In that case, all right, they're not a deep water system. And lakes. Okay, oops. For tidal, yeah, well, for tidal, we are talking again about, for deep water systems, we're talking about permanently flooded areas. And the criteria that is used is related to the tides. So at the very lowest level that the tide will go, the farthest out the water goes into the ocean, okay, during the spring tides, not the neap tides, during the spring tides, because they have the greatest fluctuation. Okay, during the spring tides, that is the point of the deep water zone. All right. So these are permanently flooded brackish marshes or marine systems. All right. And just to refresh your memory what a spring tide is. Spring tide is when the earth, the moon, and the sun are in line with each other. It's when we have full moons and new moons. And neap tides are when the moon is perpendicular to Earth and the sun. And when the moon is in line with the Earth and the sun, that's when you have the greatest gravitational pull on the Earth, and hence the tides are the greatest. So this is, again, the extreme low level portion mark of the of tides. Or fluctuation of tides is during the spring tides. Okay? And full moons are usually more extreme than new moons. Okay. Any questions with that? Pretty neat animation, huh? For a neap tide, yeah. So here we have, right when it's like that, spring, neap. So again, when we're here, you have a new moon, then I guess first quarter, full moon, third quarter. All right.
So there's more pole when it's between the sun and the most pole?
When you have a full moon. Full moon is, when is the full moon? Is it here?
Right there.
Or is it here?
I would think that'd be a new because
it's shaded by Earth. Yeah, so here's your full moon. That's right. That's right. So full moon is here and new moon is on the other side. Okay. All right. Any other questions? All right, for those who are listening at home, we're just looking at the animation, which you have to be present to see it, but the graphic is animated on the bottom left. Okay, so the next thing is moving on to classification system. The classification system is a hierarchical system. Much like many of the keys that you're used to working through to classify, for example, some type of biological taxa. It is broken down. It starts hierarchically at the greatest level being systems, then subsystems below that, classes below that, subclasses, and then finally dominance, types, and modifiers. With respect to wetland mapping, you are required, at least for your assignment, to classify down through subclass. You don't have to include the dominance, type, or modifiers, although that is a good thing to indicate in your write-up. Okay? All right. So the different systems that we have five different systems. The first is marine, second is estuarine, third is riverine, fourth is lacustrine, and the fifth is palustrine. And these five classes all differ based on hydrologic, geomorphic, chemical, and biological characteristics. They're all very, very distinct. So in the, in the undergrad course, we just talked about palustrine. And so this time, now you're going to learn all of them. And of course, this will be new for y'all that haven't taken the wetlands undergrad course. All right, so this is kind of the way it's broken down through class. Kind of gives you an illustration of this hierarchical nature of the classification system. And I believe there's a handout that, or maybe not. I guess I don't have this directly, but yeah, this handout, the very last one I handed out, kind of shows you the classification system down through down through class. Oh, and subclass. Good. That's even better than this one. Okay. So again, we have the palustrine system, which we talked about in the undergrad class at the bottom here, because it is the most common system of wetlands. And we'll talk about the other ones here as we go through. Okay? So notice that marine has two subsystems called subtidal and intertidal. Estuarine has two subsystems, the same subtidal, intertidal. Riverine has four subsystems, tidal, lower perennial, upper perennial, intermittent. Lacustrine has limnetic and littoral. And then notice that there is no subsystem. This is an important thing to remember because as you're tested, the palustrine system has no subsystem. I may ask a trick question, what is the subsystem for palustrine within some type of question, for example, on the exam. And that is to test your knowledge to recognize, oh, you know what, there isn't one, dummy. Okay. Okay. And many of the classes that are listed here actually but many classes are represented in different subsystems. So they're not unique to each of these. Some are a little more unique than others, like for example, reef, which we really won't talk about because that's almost, that's an easy one, kind of implied, but we know what a reef is, but all the other ones we'll pretty much talk about those types of classes, the different classes. Okay. So let's start off with the marine system. And what we'll first do is go through the systems and the subsystems. Then we'll go through all of the classes and subclasses, because again, many of the classes and subclasses can be in several different systems. So the marine system is, as the name implies, it's open ocean. Okay, open ocean overlying the continental shelf and its coastline, where salinities are at least over 30 parts per thousand. 30 parts per thousand, except at the mouths of an estuary, okay, where there is fresh water that may be, or brackish water that may be coming out into the ocean. At that point, it can be still the marine system and be less than 30 parts per thousand, all right? I will recommend that you really kind of listen to the cues that I'm giving you, because I'm going to give you so many details over the next three lectures, and then I'm going to test you on all different multiple combinations of those details. Like I mentioned before, the point of a graduate level course is really to master the concepts and to be able to think independently under all different types of scenarios. John's taken this course before, and the test is pretty challenging, isn't it? I mean, you really, really have to think through every single step and have it clear in your brain. Just don't memorize stuff and be very aware of, because I can just throw in a little thing that has it below 30 parts per thousand. If you're keying in on that and I have all these things that may suggest that it's a different system or a marine system or something, and then throw in one little aspect, it can change what type of system it's in. Okay, so we're dealing with open water systems. These are also considered generally high energy systems, where you have wave action, etc. Open ocean, always kind of think that. Now, I'm going to tell you where it ends. Okay, the marine system ends at this extreme high water limit of spring tides. So the low water limit, right, that's where the deep water habitat begins. The deep water system begins. The extreme high part of the spring tides is where the marine system ends. But not always. There's going to be a lot of ores in here. All right? Ore ends when you have emergent wetland vegetation. Okay? If you hit emergent wetland vegetation, you're going to be in a different system. That system actually is going to be the estuarine system. But there are other criteria that make it an estuarine system besides just having emergent vegetation. So you have to know intimately what the requirements for the estuarine system. And if the estuarine system is present, then it's not going to be the marine system. All right, and that can, well, once we get to that, it should be hopefully be a little bit clear. Or when you go out in the ocean beyond the continental shelf, then it's just called the ocean extent. Okay, it's not within this classification system if you're beyond the continental shelf. All right, there are two subsystems, subtidal and intertidal. Subtidal is, again, the deep water system, the deep water zone. And so that's where that substrate is continuously covered. It is the farthest extent of the low water zone of the spring tides. That is subtidal from there on. Intertidal would be then that area that is exposed. Okay, so substrate that is exposed or flooded by the tides. That the intertidal zone is considered a wetland, okay, in the marine system. But again, what is critical here is that you have high salinity, and It is open ocean. It's open ocean, and it's not estuarine. Because, again, estuarine will have both of these possibilities as well. All right, so what does it mean to be estuarine? Oh, here are some pictures, excuse me. So some pictures of the subtidal or the intertidal zone for the marine system. Okay, so the intertidal zone is the zone that is being exposed when the tide goes out. But notice here for all of these that you are exposed to open ocean here. And there is no standing emergent vegetation. All right. In fact, the intertidal zone also includes what is called the splash zone. So it will go as far as when the tides are up, the farthest extent of the high tides, where that water splashes, still will be considered a wetland. Okay? All right. Subtidal are, again, the deep water zones. They're permanently flooded all the way out to the continental shelf. So they can include areas like these kelp beds, coral reefs, even deeper water zones all the way out to the continental shelf, the end of the continental shelf. Okay? Clear? All right. So what about estuarine? Estuarine are tidal deep water systems and wetlands that are semi-enclosed by land but have open, partly obscured, obstructed, or sporadic access to the open ocean. Okay? So they're semi-enclosed by land. Semi-enclosed by land, but they have some connection with the ocean. So usually these are more low-energy systems that are associated with a river that comes out into the ocean, or that are associated with a bay, because their bays are semi-enclosed. They have salinity that is greater than 5 parts per thousand, or 0.5 parts per thousand. That 0.5 parts per thousand is the cutoff zone for freshwater. So in other words, they are brackish or above. Brackish or above. They extend, and where it ends and enters the marine system is an imaginary line across a bay or the mouth of a river. Okay, that's the key. It's a key. The key character. One of the key characteristics. Or where there is wetland vegetation, emergent wetland vegetation that goes beyond number two. Okay. They also include offshore areas that may be diluted by fresh water through some type of underground freshwater seep. All right. So it could mean open ocean that is diluted by a freshwater seep. Well, that just happens. Those are geologic phenomena. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Different ocean vents and stuff like that. Yeah. Yeah. And it's not associated with a river mouth. So you could have maybe, let's say, salinity being 10 parts per thousand, open ocean not associated with a river that is associated with an ocean vent, and that area would be considered, that little portion would be considered an estuarine system. Yeah.
Does this imaginary line, is it a set line like across the across the, let's say if it's a direct outlet of the river, mm-hmm. across the
mouth, yeah.
surf right there at the beach, or does it move with the tides of the salinity change?
Okay. No, it does not move. Okay, so the question was, where does this imaginary line go? It actually goes right at the river mouth. It does not move with the tide. Okay, so it's based on the river mouth.
So if the salinity changes, then will it change from estuarine to more of a brackish?
Well, the salinity can change. That's fine. Okay. That's fine. And actually, again, it has to be above 0.5, yeah. But the marine system can have lower than 30 parts per thousand at a river mouth. And it becomes marine past that imaginary line. So it could have 25 parts per thousand at the river mouth. It's marine. If it's 25 parts per thousand associated with an ocean vent, though, it's estuarine. Okay? So that's kind of the fine difference. Again, we have the exact same subsystems here, subtidal, which is, again, substrate that is continuously submerged, and then intertidal, substrate that is exposed and flooded by the tides, which is the intertidal portion of the estuarine system is the wetland portion. Okay? Good? Pretty clear? Yeah. All right, so here's kind of an example. Let's take a look over there on the left where you have a bay. And let's blow that up a little bit. You can see down here in the bottom left corner, here's a bay. And where would the estuarine system end and the marine system start? Right across here, just from this point to the mainland. And so, yes, in fact, you can have salinity levels here, 30 parts per thousand, etc. But again, the whole estuarine idea is that there is some protection. This is a low energy area. Okay. For the river mouth that you see up here, again, kind of looking at it and looking at where we would draw the line. Again, we would draw the line from this point on the left side over to the right side. And so right here, you're estuarine, estuarine, estuarine. You cross that line and it's marine. You're open ocean. Okay? Is that clear? All right. Or it can go beyond both of these lines. If you have emergent wetland vegetation, either herbaceous or woody. So for example, like mangrove coming out, or here you have some type of probably spartina or something like that, some herbaceous emergent wetland vegetation. Okay, so it'll go out beyond that if this is present. Now how much is for, we'll talk a little bit about that later on, but for the Fish and Wildlife Service classification system, the cutoff point is 30% horizontal cover. 30% horizontal cover is considered dominant. That is different than the Corps of Engineers, remember, which is over 50%. So that's an important percent. Those are two important percentages to keep separate with respect to criteria.
Is that for 100 square meters?
For, well, we'll talk about different plot sizes, yeah. But, yeah. Usually with woody vegetation, you use a 400 meter square plot. All right, here's an example here of where you have a creek that's coming in, a freshwater creek. Here's open ocean out here. But you have a river coming in. It definitely has tidal influence because it connects with the ocean. This zone here, though, okay, Even though the water may come up at high tide and flood it, this zone is an estuarine system, and this zone, the permanently flooded zone here, would be the subtidal zone, where the intertidal zone is the portion that is exposed. Okay? Why? Because it's associated with a creek or a river that's coming out. If that did not exist, you all, it would be, and it was just rocky stuff here and the open ocean, then it's marine. Simple as that. Unless there's some type of emergent vegetation. Is that clear? If this creek did not exist, then it would be a marine system, because it would be completely exposed to the open ocean and does not have a creek associated with it or a river associated with it. Okay? Is that clear? All right. Rivering. All right. Riverine are all deep water systems and wetlands contained within a channel, except the following. If it is dominated by persistent emergent plants, trees, shrubs, mosses, or lichens. We will talk about what persistent emergent vegetation means. Okay? Basically, persistent, as the name implies, means it stands up for a period of time. And the period of time, if it's herbaceous vegetation, is not through the growing season, but until the next growing season. We'll define that later on when we talk about, because persistent emergent vegetation is a subclass. Okay? So if it is dominated by, if it's within a channel and it's dominated by persistent emergent plants, or it's dominated by trees or shrubs, mosses and lichens are usually not the case with us in our systems, then it is not a riverine system. It's not a riverine system. It is a different system. It's actually a palustrine system. Or if the salinity is greater than 0.5 parts per thousand. So riverine systems are freshwater systems. Okay, that's an important thing. Because if I give you a scenario where you have a river coming out and explain all this stuff about it being in a channel and I throw it in there that it's at one part per thousand, it's estuarine. Okay, the estuarine system, the riverine system ends even if it's within a channel, and the estuarine system begins when you go over 0.5 parts per thousand. And then that continues, the estuarine system continues past the to the river mouth and potentially past there if you have emergent vegetation.
So if emergent vegetation creeps up into the riverine system, where's kind of the cutoff
okay.
from palustrine to estuarine? Is that the
freshwater? Yeah. Yeah. So the question is, where do these things, you know, kind of cut off at? And let's kind of, I'm coming over here and writing on the board, and I'm making a channel here that's going to go out to the ocean. All right. And so I'm just drawing a channel that then comes out to an ocean. And I am going to, at the bottom here, I'm going to put a little squiggly line that really represents salinity. And salinity at that line becomes less than 0.5 parts per thousand. Okay? At that point, it's a freshwater system. And it being a freshwater system within a channel means it's riverine. If it doesn't contain persistent vegetation. If it contains persistent vegetation or trees, so let's say down here we had some trees, let's say, some cypress or something like that, maybe on the edge of the channel, just drawing that in, two bands of vegetation on the edge of the channel that say those are trees. Okay. That is a different system. It's actually, that is palustrin, even if it's within the channel. Or if it contains, again, persistent emergent vegetation, which we'll define later. Past this, as we go closer towards the ocean and we're greater than 0.5 parts per thousand, then you are within the estuarine system. And that continues to, again, this imaginary line across the mouth of the river where it becomes marine. And at that point, you could still be below 30 parts per thousand. You may not be, but you could be below. 30 parts per thousand is generally considered, that and above is considered the salinity of seawater. But at this point, it can be, as long as there isn't any persistent emergent vegetation. If there is at the mouth, let's say there's some that comes out, then the zone of the estuarine, and it may actually even run down the shore here, the zone of the estuarine system here follows that line of where there is persistent emergent vegetation or trees. Persistent emergent vegetation. Okay, is that clear? All right. In fact, drawing some type of schematic might be a good type, like that might be a good type of question. All right. What idea? Yeah.
How, like, I'm just not familiar with the systems at all, but how far could theoretically, like, estuarine run up? I know you just drew that, but, like, in real life, like, can they go up, like, miles, like, to the Mississippi River?
Depends on the depth of the river.
Yeah, yeah. So the question is, how far can the estuarine system run up? Well, it can run up a long ways. It depends on depth and slope and et cetera. For example, in Louisiana, many of those, the estuarine system can run literally miles and miles and miles upstream, yeah.
Depends on rainfall, too.
Well, yeah, it does. Rainfall is going to influence that some. And I guess that overall, you would usually kind of draw that, you know, during an average time period, something like that is where you would make the delineation, not right after a rain event.
Like, it goes back to tides, too. Do you use, when you're trying to figure out the end of your estuarine, do you go to high tide, wait on high tide to figure out where it goes? Because your high tide, of course, is going to push it.
Right, right, right.
High tide on an average year.
High tide on, what's that?
On an average year as well, because yeah. You know, high tide's going to vary, I mean, depending on the rainfall as well,
mm-hmm.
How much fresh water is pouring down the Mississippi.
Yeah, so, well. Right, so it would be, that's a good question, how far does it go up? Yeah, and again, that point of 0.5 parts per thousand should be the farthest extent that would go in a normal year. Now, you also, fresh water is lighter than salt water. So you have a phenomena called a saltwater wedge that can be created, well, that is created always when you have a freshwater system flowing into a saltwater system. And the way that looks, again, for those at home, I'm just drawing on the board kind of a section that represents a section of water, two parallel lines. And you have something that'll look like, and I'm drawing from the bottom left to the top right across and connecting those lines, making almost like two triangles. And again, fresh water is on top, and on the top triangle, and salt water is on the bottom. Okay? And so you will get some, actually the way that it really looks is instead of going all the way up, on a 45-degree angle. As it gets up towards the top here, it usually will very gradually intersect the surface of the water. Okay? And that may actually extend for a good distance. So how far do you really, where do you draw that line, right? Well, those criteria actually are not specified exactly. But you have two choices here. You could certainly do it, right when you drop down right below the surface. And, of course, that's going to give you a farther ocean direction or delineation. Or you could actually drop it down to the bottom, and that'll be more inland, an old, more inland delineation. Or you could actually find these extents and then basically go right in the midpoint and say, that's where I'm going to make my delineation. Okay. So the idea of the biological classification system is what can be influencing the biota. So, you know, you could use either one of these, really. I mean, if you want to be most conservative, you would go towards the freshwater end of it and see how far at the bottom the wedge extends inland, 0.5 parts per thousand.
Most conservative for which aspect? The estuarine?
Most conservative for the estuarine. And the reason I mention that is that usually this represents a stressor. Salt represents a stressor. It really kind of works both ways, but it usually is a stressor on freshwater plants, and that's what you usually will see influencing those populations most. Okay. Any other questions? All right. So is the question using fish instead of plants or other biotic because plants and fish and stuff can move, you know, these criteria are set up on abiotic characteristics such as salinity and the presence of things like plants that really, well, establish in conditions that allow them to establish.
I'll say about sharks where they go upstream.
Right.
Upstream,
yeah, or manatees or whatever. Right. Right. Now, yeah, I mean, that just adds way too much variability and subjectivity to things. And if we followed organisms to see, you know, where they would. And, I mean, this is a relatively consistent criteria that you could apply across all types of systems.
Yeah, because there was a manatee close to Memphis, wasn't there?
Yeah, I don't know how far. Did it go all the way up? Yeah. Up near Memphis, up the Mississippi.
So it would be a long estuarine zone.
Yeah, right, right. Okay, so the riverine system ends at the upland boundary as we go up towards the terrestrial system. For example, it ends at the estuarine system or another system like the palustrine system. Or if you get all the way up to the upper reaches to the spring where it originates. There are four subsystems underneath of the riverine system: lower perennial, upper perennial, intermittent, and tidal. Okay? Lower perennial are low gradient streams and low flow streams, very slow. The substrate, if you take a core sample or a dredge sample, drop it down through the water column and get a sample of the substrate, is mud or sand. Mud or sand. We'll talk about what separates mud and sand later on. related to particular particle size. Upper perennial are your fast-moving streams that we are familiar with, especially here in East Tennessee, although we certainly have lower perennial streams as well. So these are high gradient streams, high flow. Substrate is rock and gravel and cobble as well. So some type of rock composition or a high rock composition. intermittent is water flows only during parts of the year. So it could be an intermittent stream. Many of these streams are associated maybe with higher elevations, like out in the northwest, associated with glaciers, such as around Mount Hood, etc. Also, streams in the desert southwest and areas of the central United States that receive very little rainfall, except in short durations where streams may dry out, but then there's a huge pulse of rain that comes in and floods the river channel. Okay, and then we have tidal. Again, you can have tidal influence within the riverine system, but again, this is the flow fluctuates with the tide, but it's still fresh water. Okay? So that subsystem, you could have the riverine system that could be lower perennial to the point as you're going towards the ocean where it, then you have some type of tidal fluctuation in that portion, then the subsystem changes. System's still the same, okay? The subsystem changes to tidal. Goes from lower perennial to tidal, and then from there it goes into the estuarine and it's either subtidal or intertidal. So the estuarine always has some type of tidal influence, of course, along with the marine, and that defines its two subsystems. Okay, is that clear? Pretty simple? All right. So this is what we, lower perennial, picture of a lower perennial slow moving stream, again, that where the substrate is dominated by silt and mud, and upper perennial fast moving streams on the right here, rocks and cobble and et cetera. Intermittent streams like you see here with, that looks like Mount St. Helens. It doesn't have a top. I don't know if it is or not. And then we have finally, I didn't put tidal in here. Intermittent actually can look two different ways. It can look like you have here where you have, for example, a gravel type bed, or it's just substrate that's exposed. It could be sand or something like that as well, mud, like in the desert southwest, or it also could be filled up with vegetation, like you see here, but that vegetation must be non-persistent vegetation. Okay, it cannot be persistent. If this is non-persistent vegetation, then it's still considered the riverine system until you hit these trees. Or if this is persistent emergent vegetation, an example of persistent emergent vegetation is cattails. Okay, keep that in your head until we talk about persistent emergent. Non-persistent topples actually at the end of the growing season. Like actually this is non-persistent. This is a type of panic grass which will fall over at the end of the growing season. That would still be within the riverine system. Okay, intermittent if there's no water there. If there's water there, if it has water flowing through there, which is kind of hard for that type of vegetation to establish, usually needs to be exposed, then it would be lower perennial. All right, any questions? How are we doing on time right now? 5 o'clock. Okay, good. All right, next system, lacustrine. Lacustrine. The lacustrine system are freshwater deep water habitats and wetlands with the following characteristics. Okay, and it depends on the surface area, whether or not the area is greater than 8 hectares or less than 8 hectares. All right? If it's greater than 8 hectares, it's all areas that are positioned within a topographic depression, either glacially formed or wind formed, or it could be a dammed river channel, like a reservoir. All right, or a farm pond. Okay, and areas that are greater than 8 hectares in surface area, where there is less than 30% coverage of persistent emergent vegetation. Non-persistent emergent vegetation can be present. So we're talking about large areas, again, that are like lakes or reservoirs, and areas that have non-persistent vegetation that are large, okay? Or nothing, or it could just be substrate. Or areas that are less than 8 hectares in size, with number 1 and 2 above and one of the criteria below. So you have to have both of these present. If you're small, okay, you have to have both of these present, not just one of them, but both of them present, and you have to have one more below that has to also be present if it's small. You have to have a waveform shoreline, or the deepest part of the basin has to be greater than 2 meters. Okay? All right. So what we're talking about here are ponds, lakes, and reservoirs. That's just what we've described. Yeah?
What if the coverage of persistent vegetation is greater than 30%, but it's still deep water?
Well, that's
like
not going to happen. Well, it's not going to be over 2 meters. That's not going to.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, when it gets over 2 meters, bald cypress can't survive for long durations when it's that deep.
Is that horizontal coverage?
This is horizontal coverage. That's right. That's right. Yeah. You're dealing with lake systems. I mean, your persistent vegetation is going to disappear. Mm-hmm. All right. But that's a good question. That's a good question. So yes, it's let me just back up. If that happens, I don't think that's going to happen. It's just biologically, it needs to be shallower than that. They'll die. Okay? But if that did happen, well, it isn't, so why even talk about it? I'll just confuse people if I talk about it. But these are the criteria. If that happened, all right, let's just talk about something crazy. All right? If it's positioned in a topographic depression, it doesn't matter, but if there is persistent vegetation, it's greater than 30, all right, then it is plustern, it's not lacustrine. Okay. But that, biologically, that doesn't happen. Usually at that point, you're getting into an open water zone. You may have submergent vegetation, rooted vascular plants, water lilies, stuff like that. But that's fine. Okay. Water lilies, etc., do not classify as persistent emergent vegetation, or obviously they're not trees. So, okay. So now, what about the other question? Is what about farm ponds? Farm ponds are the perfect example of falling into this category. They are small. Are they lacustrine? Well, that depends. Is their deepest part during low water greater than 2 meters deep? there are a lot of farm ponds that aren't, and there are some farm ponds that are. Okay? If it is greater than 2 meters deep, then it is lacustrine until you hit persistent emergent vegetation. Once you hit that, you're in palustrine. So some farm ponds have lacustrine and palustrine systems present. Okay. All right, subsystems, you have the limnetic zone, which is all the deep water zones. Where's the deep water zone? Greater than 2 meters, right. And then the wetland zone is less than 2 meters. Until you hit persistent emergent vegetation. Okay? Good? All right, so what are we talking about here? So yeah, littoral zone extends from the upland, okay, or to the palustrine system. Usually lacustrine runs into palustrine. And then it goes out, obviously, to 2 meters depth, littoral zone of the lacustrine. Okay, so what do these things look like? Well, what we're talking about, again, are big lakes, okay, such as the Great Lakes, like up here, that's Lake Superior, that's off my dock, that's Lake Loudoun, or even farm ponds, like we have throughout the state of Tennessee, up until you hit the persistent, if this is greater than 2 meters deep, until you hit the persistent emergent vegetation. This is, actually, those are cattails, all right? Once it's lacustrine out here, until it hits those cattails, then it's palustrine. There's a little bit of palustrine here, then you're in the upland. So it depends on, to be lacustrine, depends on the size. The 8 hectare size depends on the depth and depends on if there's persistent or non-persistent vegetation. Non-persistent, you're good to go. Okay. This is the other thing that is important to clarify before I show you that, is that it can include shallow basins. It does not need to be greater than 2 meters in depth. Make sure you are clear about that. It can be a rainwater basin or a playa lake, something that is, for example, well, greater than 8 hectares, but some playa lakes cover a section, a quarter of a section, okay, which is what, about 100 acres or so? No, 640 is a full section, so 150, 160, yeah, quarter section is 160, yeah. 160 acres. If that playa lake or that basin, for example, is dominated by non-persistent emergence, it's dried up and it's dominated by non-persistent, which most are. There aren't trees out in the great, very many, okay, out in the Great Plains or the Southern High Plains, okay? Those are lacustrine systems if they're greater than 8 hectares in size, okay? So you have some rainwater basins, the big ones, again, greater than 8 hectares, that are definitely lacustrine. And then you have some that are palustrine. If they're smaller than 8 hectares, they have to have that deep water zone. Okay, is that clear? Important distinction to make. Okay, I don't even know why I have that on there. So this just kind of illustrates, you know, limnetic zone here. Is your deep water zone over 2 meters, the littoral zone is less than 2 meters. And again, you can have vegetation here, you may or may not, but you can have submergent rooted vegetation or floating vegetation all the way up until you hit this persistent emergent vegetation. Then it becomes palustrine. Is that clear? This is a limnology figure that I used to use, the epilimnion, metalimnion, hypolimnion. You guys don't need to know that. But you can take limnology to learn about that stuff. Okay. Any questions about the lacustrine? Have I completely confused you all? Hopefully not. Hopefully it's relatively clear. Palustrin. Now, this is our last system here. This is the one that y'all learned about, okay, and that were in the undergrad course. All freshwater wetlands dominated by, which again means over 30% coverage, by trees, shrubs, persistent emergent vegetation, emergent mosses, and lichens. We'll define those things later on. Okay, and they can be tidal or non-tidal, but they can't, again, they cannot be saltwater. Salinity has to be less than 0.5 parts per thousand. They include all wetlands lacking the above vegetation or dominated by non-persistent emergence that have all of the following characteristics. They have to be small. That's what we were just talking about, because if they're big, they're going to be lacustrine. If they don't have any vegetation, mean you just have exposed substrate. You just have substrate. That's it. Okay? But it meets, of course, we're still talking about wetlands. We still are dealing with wetlands. It meets the wetland criteria. Or it has non-persistent emergence. Okay? And it doesn't have an active waveform shoreline. Okay? Because if it has an active waveform shoreline, and it's even less than 8 hectares, it is still lacustrine. Okay? And it's less than 2 meters in depth. Palustrine wetlands are always shallow wetlands. They do not include deep water zones. And they're fresh. Oh, okay. Yeah. All right.
Should there be an equal sign greater or less than and equal to 0.5 parts per trillion?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, actually there should be. Says less than?
Mm-hmm.
Is that in the manual?
Mm-hmm.
There you go. No, I was right.
So, then the other one should be greater than or equal to?
Greater than or equal to, I guess. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's thanks for that clarification. I'm happy you had the manual here. Yeah, so those are correct. So it's less than for these criteria. It's greater than or equal to for, I guess, the other criteria. Yeah. Well, just think of, you know, like a lake, okay, where you have, you don't have any vegetation, it's wave-formed. Usually you have sand or rocks or some type of, like a lake. In other words, what this is saying is, if it's small, you can have a small lake. And if you have an active wave-formed shoreline, then it's not palustrine. I get, yeah. Is that okay? In a small, well, yeah, I know. Yeah, you usually don't. I mean, but that is in there just in case it does happen. There may be some.
A farm pond hits water and it just pretty much drops off and there's vegetation all the way
right.
In the water. That's not waveform.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, but see, if you have. I'm just thinking here of the farm ponds that we've worked with. And most farm ponds, or they're almost, I don't know if there's any, they're 8 hectares in size. The ones that we worked on, the largest one was about 1.5 hectares. And, excuse me. Now I'm trying to remember what size they were. Well, heck no, I don't remember. I better not say that. But our largest one, you could get some waves going across it when the wind was really blowing. And if it was big enough, you could maybe get wave form shoreline. I know you have it. There are certain cases where that would be the case. I guess it doesn't happen very often. So the bottom line is if it did happen, then it's not palustrine. Okay. Until you hit persistent emergent vegetation. All right.
Might have more in the plains area than here.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's probably a better case scenario. Yeah, because you know you have wide open areas, the wind gets going a lot faster, and you know you can get wind fetch, etc. So. Yeah, I know. I mean, it's whether it occurs very often or not, I don't really know. I mean, I would say that across our great nation, it occurs once. With reasonable certainty. maybe not twice, but at least once. Okay. I do want to come back and note that, again, it could, if you had persistent emergent vegetation, it could be greater than 2 meters in depth, and it would be palustrine, okay? Again, that does not occur very often or almost ever. I mean, I can't even with deep water sloughs. All right, any questions? All right, so you can definitely, we've been talking about a lot of different criteria here. You can imagine how I can literally think of 100 different combinations to mix these things up to challenge really your understanding of what goes in. And the best way to do it is don't leave it here. I would do what Megan's done, which is get the manual and read through that and make sure you're very, very clear with these criteria, okay? All right, and there's no subsystem for palustrine. There's technically no deep water zone. That's why. So, I mean, it shouldn't be greater than 2 meters depth. Yeah. I mean, that is one of those cases where I don't know if it ever happens.
When we're talking about 30% coverage, are we talking on shrubs and stuff and the cattails and out that it gets so packed in that
right.
But on the trees, are we talking about basal area or are we talking about coverage?
Horizontal cover, yeah, canopy cover. That's correct.
So then I understand what you're saying, it wouldn't happen very often, but at the same time, if you did have a slough or something, a cypress slough that had a channel in it of some sort, I could see it would be pretty easy
mm-hmm.
to get 2 meters in the middle.
Oh, yeah.
Cover the whole thing.
Indeed.
I think one place off the Mississippi where we did that turtle trap this summer that was definitely like that.
Mm-hmm. So if it's within a channel though, which is certainly usually going to be the case, well, note those scenarios, then it's the riverine system.
Well, I said channel, maybe that's the wrong word, but
yeah.
an isolated slough
mm-hmm.
maybe with an oxbow kind
yeah.
of situation that used to be a channel.
Yeah. Yeah. If that happens, again, like I said before, if it happens where during most of the years it's over 2 meters deep and you have greater than 30% horizontal cover of trees, it is palustrine. Again, cypress trees need it dry in order to establish. So I don't see how that's going to happen where, yes, it can be over 2 meters at certain times of the year, no doubt. But cypress knees need to get above the water in order for the trees to survive. I mean, you still need to, the trees themselves still need to get oxygen down to the roots. And if that, now can that happen too in an altered system? Yeah, it happens all the time, and the damn trees die, and then it turns into a lacustrine system. So, yeah, I mean, it's naturally, these things, that usually doesn't happen. But if it did, you know, usually what you're doing is you're getting, when it gets deeper, you're going to get to the deep water zone. And it may not be lacustrine, but leave it there. We're talking about scenarios that are really kind of unrealistic. So I don't want to make things more confusing than hopefully that they aren't. But anyways, is that clear? All right. So we're dealing with systems. Clustering systems, usually like freshwater marshes, hardwood bottomlands, shrub areas like buttonbush areas, and moss and lichen areas. All right, and there's an illustration of clustering. All right, so is it 5:30?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let me see where we are. I see somebody's handouts. So we're at classes. Okay. Yeah, let's go ahead and work through these. Yeah. So let's talk about what classes are. Classes describe the general appearance of a wetland. This says for a clustering system, but that does not need to be there. This is classes in general. Describe the general appearance of wetlands, wetland in terms of either dominant vegetation or substrate. Again, well, we already talked about the criteria for whether we determine what type of class is based on the amount of vegetation that is out there, the cutoff for the classification system is over 30% horizontal cover, and this is important, y'all. The class is distinguished based on the uppermost layer of the vegetation, the tallest layer. Okay, make sure you highlight that, because there can be a 35% coverage of trees over top of a 95% coverage of emergent plants. And it is classified, the class is classified based on the trees. Okay, because it is the tallest layer. It also works with respect to persistence. Write this down too, because it gets everybody every single time. You can have 35% persistent emergent vegetation like cattails, and intermixed within it you have, let's just say if it was 35%, the remaining portion is completely covered with duckweed, a floating plant. So 65% duckweed, 35% persistent emergent. It is classified based on the persistent emergent because it is taller than the floating duckweed or the floating lily pads. Okay? That's a very important distinction to make. So it's the uppermost or the tallest layer of vegetation that it is classified on. Remember, all strata are given equal importance for when you are delineating wetlands. You look across all strata. But for classifying, it is the tallest strata that is most dominant, where dominance is the cutoff is strictly greater than 30%. Okay? Horizontal cover. So here's an example here. greater than 50% horizontal vegetative cover of trees, over 60% horizontal vegetative cover of shrubs would be a forested, and not a scrub-shrub wetland. And it's the same case if you have 35% horizontal cover of cattails over top of 65% horizontal cover of duckweed. It is still considered, it's classified based on the cattails, not the duckweed. All right, so yeah, so your trees are 25%. Are your, if your trees are 25% and you have 30%, 35% shrubs, it's shrub scrub. Okay, or scrub shrub wetland. So if it's less than 30, then you go to you go to another vegetation class that has greater than 30. If there is no vegetation class that is greater than 30, then if horizontal vegetation cover is less than 30, then you classify based on the substrate. Okay, and the substrate is based on texture and composition. Okay? Is that clear? All right, let's go ahead and end there.